All right. Good to hear those drums again. Damn. I should wake up every morning with those, all right? That would change my entire life, okay? I'd walk through the world differently. Anyway.
I've been missing them myself, just to let you know.
Yeah, I bet you have, man. I'm glad to see you back there, Teddy. All right. We got a packed show today. We got a packed show, all right? At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with consumer advocate and environmental activist Aaron Brockovich about what the hell is going on with the Aliso Canyon gas field and the attempts to just say, everything's cool, don't worry about it. Don't worry, you got it all under control. Yeah, okay. And before that, we will be talking with Professor Fidel Fajardo Acosta. And we'll be talking about the professor watch list and the call to professor students and all in academia starting this semester, make the university a zone of resistance to the fascist Trump. And opening the show up, you're going to get, there's a theme running around in here, okay? Opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be welcoming back to the show Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for RevCom.us and Revolution, and she's an initiator of Refused Fascism. And we're going to be talking with Sansara about Fascism on the March, her recent article, Fascism on the March, Sharpening Crisis and the Urgency to Act. Sansara, welcome back.
Hey, Michael, it's good to be with you.
Yeah. Let's jump into this. I want to get as much out of this as we can. And just so we have a common language, I was thinking it might be good because people throw around the word fascism a whole lot. And I think it would be good if you could just give people, what are we talking about when we're talking about fascism? Just what is it? A brief explanation of what is fascism?
Well, I want to answer that on two levels. One is because there's a lot of different definitions of fascism that historians and political scientists and others have come up with, and I want to talk about what I think is the essence of it. But I do want to say with refusefascism.org, when we initiated this effort, we looked at all the major definitions, and by every major definition, Trump and Pence regime fits. So before I unfold what I think is the essential features, I just want to indicate that, because if you go to the Holocaust Museum, they have a list of things that they define as fascism. He fits that description. If you look at different scholars, he fits that description. What I understand to be the most essential dimension of fascism is the reordering and the reconfiguring of the ruling state in a way that is more openly, blatantly violent, terroristic, and a more blatant form of dictatorship, and one that unleashes and whips up organized fanatical thugs to target and demonize and carry out violent terror against those who are deemed undesirable, enemies of this society, or in other ways demonized. And I think fascism has the extreme nationalism, the xenophobia, that is the fear and hatred of immigrants and others, the gross misogyny and hatred of women. These are all cornerstones of every fascist society. But I think, you know, we've lived in a capitalist imperialist society. It's not that America has never carried out wars for empire. It has. It's not that America didn't carry out slavery. It did. It's not that it hasn't already been carrying out mass incarceration and police murder and closing down and taking away women's right to abortion or doing mass deportations under Obama and previous administrations. All of that is true. But Trump and Pence are not merely, and this is why I think it's right to call them fascists, they're not merely worsening every front of this, although they are even more grotesquely anti-woman, even more viciously anti-immigrants, even more viciously carrying out terroristic threats and domination around the world. All those things are true. But at its essence, they are actually tearing up what have been at least professed democratic rights and protections of the people and norms through which this capitalist state has functioned. And so just to give one very specific example of this, there are many. There's just the all-out assault on the truth, the propaganda of propagating of lie after lie after lie, and the open threats against the media or the muzzling of government agencies for reporting anything that contradicts that, the firing of an attorney general for pointing out that Trump's Muslim ban violated, was likely illegal and unconstitutional, so she wasn't going to defend it. Never mind, you're fired. This kind of trampling of the traditional and foundational checks and balances, the professed rights of the people, the professed rule of law, all of these things, and being even more openly, violently, blatantly, and terroristically a dictatorship that is terrorizing the oppressed and crushing and destroying the space for people to raise their head and to dissent and to criticize and resist and challenge that authority.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I was thinking about as I was preparing for this, this basic point that you're making, there's this, and people have to get this, that it's more than each individual act of disgusting nationalism and all this other crap that he's doing, that all the things that he's like unleashing on the world and here and around the world. And, you know, just listening to people talking about the raid that he did in Yemen and all this stuff that's happening, the slaughter that he's actually behind and what he's done. Yes, the things you were talking about, the bans and all this other stuff. But there's also an importance to actually seeing that there's a coherence here that actually is more than somebody like, you know, okay, Obama did all these killings in the Middle East. All these other people have done all this other stuff. It's more than the horror of each individual act. There actually is a shell that contains all these and actually drives it forward. And that's important for people to understand in terms of knowing what they're fighting against.
Yeah, I think it's very important. It's also important in what you're saying. I'm listening and I'm thinking about how often people right now, it's dizzying, the pace of edicts and executive orders and threats and disruptions of millions of people's lives and the threats to dishevel and destroy millions more lives. The pace of it is just stunning. I mean, you can't keep up with it. Yesterday, Sean Spicer makes up some whole incident of Iranian alleged attack on U.S. ships, which is Saudi Arabia. I mean, Kellyanne Conway invokes the need for this ban because of a Bowling Green massacre that never existed. She just makes this stuff up. And, you know, you can't keep up with the pace of the lies. You can't keep up with the chaos it's causing. And a lot of people have this tendency, and there's all these articles right now saying, oh, this is bad management style. They have this tendency to think this is, and the Democrats are saying it all the time, Pelosi, this is incompetence. They're not fit. This is not incompetence. This is actually, there's both a method to the madness and a madness to the method. These people, the Trump-Pence regime, they are radically setting out to reorder the entire world and the way in which the U.S. has held itself together domestically. And they want to keep people off balance. This is part of what fascism does to it. There's a shock and an awe to it and an F you, we don't care. For example, a lot of people think that the Muslim ban was so disruptive, and it is wrong. But one of the things people will say, well, not only did you ban all these people who might be refugees and desperate and maybe we'd have to take care of them or maybe they'd wish us bad, all of which is the wrong framework and not founded in reality. But then they say, but what about all these people in Silicon Valley? What about all the disruptions to U.S. economy? What about all these skilled people who are being kept out? And if you look into it, this is not a mistake. This is not something they were sloppy, they overreached, they didn't write clear wording. You go back and Steve Bannon's been talking about doing this for years. He's been talking about getting the South Asians out of Silicon Valley. It's just one example. It's not the heart of the package. It's one example. But I think there's a danger of people thinking this is incompetence or just recklessness rather than they're sending a message. And they are consciously shredding and tearing up what has been the existing relations with foreign powers, the existing relations of how they've conducted themselves internationally, and the existing relations with the courts, with the Congress, with government agencies, with science, with the campuses, which is very ominous, and with civil society. They mean what they're saying and doing, and the shock and the awe and the seeming madness to it is part of the agenda. It's a indication of just how extreme and relentlessly they're going to hammer forward and why they have to be stopped. They are fascist and they mean it, and they have to be stopped. They have to be driven out. They can't be worked with. They can't be resisted piecemeal. You can't kind of work around each policy issue. You get overwhelmed even trying to keep up with them. They have to be taken on as a whole.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper, RevCom.us, and one of the initiators of RefuseFascism.org. And we're talking about her recent piece called Fascism on the March, Sharpening Crisis and the Urgency to Act. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I was thinking when you were talking about his role in relation to international relations, and I was thinking that, and then another thing as well, I'll get into in a minute, but there's sort of this cavalier kind of, he's the bad guy coming to town, or he's the good guy, whatever, coming to town to straighten all this stuff out. And the idea, people keep talking about he's been sort of ignorant around people, he's insulted them, he's hung up on them, he's done all this stuff. But there is an overall approach. And one of the things I kept thinking about in relation to all this is that in the very beginning, when Refuse Fascism first began, the point was made that this fascism, we really do need to stop it. And it would have been much better to have been able to have stopped it before they came in and took power. now that they are in power, there's a real need to actually really even more of a need to actually step up and to stop this. But it really does make a difference where you have, and I was thinking about this, where you could sit back now and you can say, okay, look, now they go out and they're not out there. It's not because Trump is an idiot and he's out there and he's just looking to insult all these people, but he's reshaping the international maneuvering of the U.S. and its role in the world and in relation to all these other powers. What role is it going to play, and is it going to take any bull or not? So you get in line with us or get out. There's the same kind of thing. So I thought that was really very, very heavy.
Yeah, you know, I think just to come back to this, in terms of what this is, an extreme and illegitimate regime that's come to power. I mean, it is actually ripping up what have been, even by their own standards of bourgeois democracy, which is really capitalist dictatorship, but even by their own standards, they've been shredding the normal procedures and the normal ways that the rules of their own game. This is every day they're doing this. And I think this is why they have to be identified as what they are, as fascist, and they have to be opposed. There's a very important slogan, and it gets to what you're describing about the international situation as well as the domestic situation. There's a very important slogan that was brought forward by refusefascism.org when it was first initiated, and it is, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. And this is really important because it is actually speaking to the full scope and the danger of who all is going to be harmed if this regime is allowed to barrel forward. It's not just people here. It is Muslims, but it's not just Muslims. It is women, but it's not just women. It is LGBT, but it's not just LGBT. It is definitely Black people with the white supremacy and the backing for law and order and stop and frisk and heavy-handed law enforcement terror that is being promoted. It's definitely Black people, but it's not only Black people. It's the environment and the planet, but it's not only that. It's critical thinking and the ability for the truth to have any air to breathe or for people to be able to challenge bald-faced lies that are propagated. But it's not only that. It's the whole. It's in the name of humanity. Look, when Hitler came to power, that was a very dangerous thing for many, many, many people. But they were not the sole superpower in the world. They didn't have the nuclear arsenal that Trump has. They didn't have the NSA apparatus of spying and that massive detention centers already built all over the border and millions of people already in prison and being held. They had to construct all that. Trump is coming to power with all of that in hand, and he is moving aggressively. And so this orientation of the actual stakes and our actual moral responsibility as people living here, in the name of humanity, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. That is both an injunction, a moral injunction. It's also an orientation, and it's a real goal that we have to hear very quickly. And you see the millions of people who are in agony over this. You see actually incredibly inspiring and very important outpourings of protest and resistance at the airports. You see this at 2 nights ago at Berkeley in California, the righteous protests and shutdown of the fascist operative Milo Yiannopoulos, which I would like to talk a little bit about too, because it's such a big deal. Mm-hmm. You see people, I saw this footage of Muslim Day at the Capitol in Texas, of all places. Every day these Muslims go to the Capitol, and every year, and every year these Christian fanatic thugs come and harass them. And 1 year they took it over and disrupted their thing and took over the mic and were denouncing Islam at their day at the Capitol. And this year, thousands of mainstream Texans showed up and formed a human chain, several deep, around the Muslims, protecting them from the harassment. And there was like thousands of white people, middle-class people, professional people, non-Muslims who came to stand with them. You see incredible outpourings, and you see the indications that there really are millions who, if we acted in a sustained way, if we stayed in the streets, if we didn't just voice our opposition or even fight around one or two outrages, as important as that has been, the very righteous fight that did get people released from detention, at least some of them, at the airports last weekend, is very important. But to go from that, to build on that, to go even further, to actually take responsibility for, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America, and to be oriented towards driving this regime from power. This is what the world needs from us. And this is actually, you know, there are moments in history that shape the future of generations. We are living through a moment like that, and that all the raw ingredients exist. It's very clear, you know, and people need to be more clear that this is fascist. It has a direction. It has both a direction and an aggressive nature to how fast it wants to keep people off balance and hammer itself into place. but also the convulsions of resistance and opposition, if we can seize on that and transform that so that it's deepened and people are really taking this on board in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America and we will drive them out. The basis exists to do that. And this is what RefuseFascism.org is really working on and calling on everybody to be involved in, whatever perspective you're from, whatever political beliefs, whatever religious beliefs or non-religious beliefs, however much you've been involved or not involved in protest and resistance before in your life, this is a moment we need to come together. And RefuseFascism.org is a unique vehicle for people to do that, to stop this fascist America.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper, RevCom.us, and one of the initiators of RefuseFascism.org. And we're talking about her recent piece called Fascism on the March, Sharpening Crisis and the Urgency to Act. We have about 4 minutes left, so why don't we jump into what you were just mentioning? I was going to get to that and ask you that anyway, about Berkeley. It was really a breath of fresh air and something that was really needed in relation to what went on, and it's an extremely important development. And you can see, actually, even watching Trump's midnight Twitter where he says, well, do this and defund you. We're not going to fund you anymore. And those threats are actually very real threats against what can be and should be and has been in the past, the universities being a place where people do learn what's what and where a lot of struggle actually begins to take root and rise up and spread. So let's talk about what happened in Berkeley a couple days ago.
Yeah, well, a couple days ago, thousands of people turned out at UC Berkeley to protest and actually prevent the speaking appearance of Milo Yiannopoulos, who's a senior editor at Breitbart and a fascist operative with connections all the way up to the highest levels of the White House and power in this country, the fascist regime in this country. And so, first of all, it was righteous. It was very important. Over 100 professors took a stand against him being invited to speak to begin with. There was thousands of students who were protesting. People from across Berkeley and Oakland and the Bay Area came out to protest. And it was a determined insistence that this was not welcome in Berkeley or anywhere else. And I want to say these protests are being attacked. They're being slandered. People who were part of them are being distorted and saying, and Milo himself is saying this is an attack on free speech. The left is terrified of free speech. I want to say no. Milo Yiannopoulos is not some dude out there, even somebody with really bad and objectionable ideas, who is being denied a platform to speak. This is not a free speech issue. This man has a well-documented history of consciously and knowingly whipping up and unleashing campaigns of harassment, intimidation, threat, and violence against people who are either oppressed and marginalized, transgender people, Black people, women, as well as people who raise their voices against oppression. He's not just voicing objectionable views or deeply offensive views or even hate speech. He's actually consciously unleashed repeatedly campaigns, including the one that got him banned, the only person who's been permanently banned from Twitter, when he unleashed a campaign of harassment and threats and hacking against Leslie Jones, the Black female actress who was part of Ghostbusters, which was just racist, misogynist, and Milo feared that consciously, knowingly. There's many other examples. So on the one hand, he's unleashed these kinds of active campaigns, and this is what he was organizing. But even more fundamentally, he's somebody who is a senior editor at Breitbart. Breitbart, of course, Steve Bannon is probably the most powerful driver in the White House fascist regime right now. Milo is doing this as part of a whole fascist clampdown. It's the attack on the press. It's the muzzling of government agencies. It's the threats against anybody who challenges Trump and Pence and their lies. And there's a certain CNN is fake news. They make up lies all the time. There's a whole approach that they're taking that is trying to close down the ability of people to discern what's true and debate what's true. And in this context, the campuses in particular they're a strategic problem for the regime, because this is a place more than anywhere else in society where critical thinking has initiative. And so Milo's campaign against the campuses is part of the Nazification of the American university, the targeting of dissident professors or radical professors, the targeting of students who raise their heads, and the intimidation of them, and transforming the universities into sites of indoctrination and conformity to a fascist regime. And so this is why it was so important that people rose up there. It's so important that they're defended. And it's really important that people in other places, campuses, professors, students, but also broadly in society, that more people do the kinds of widespread and diverse protests that took place in Berkeley. It was very important.
Mm-hmm. All right, Sansara, we're going to have to leave now, but we'll have you back very soon because I want to continue this conversation. And in particular, the point that you make, which I think is extremely important for people to keep in mind, which, you know, there is a strong basis now to do what's needed. And people really have to take that on. They have to step up and meet that challenge and meet the call of history. So I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
You know, I know a lot of people are really agonizing about how and what they should be doing right now. So I know we're out of time. I thank you for having me on, but I would just encourage everybody. There's two websites to go to every day. One is revcom.us. I know Michael will let you know that a lot of the time. That's what I write for. It's the voice of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And the other is refusefascism.org, which is a much broader effort. We're part of it, but others are part of it as well. And it is a place for people to find answers, to find others in their area, to figure out what to do, to find out about other resistance. It's very important to get connected right now. And so I would just leave you with that. Go to these two websites and go there every day and spread them with your friends.
All right. Thank you very much, Sansara.
All right. Take care.
All right. Talk to you later. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for RevCom.us and Revolution Newspaper, and one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism. And we've been talking about fascism on the march, sharpening crisis, and the urgency to act. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be coming right back to talk with Professor Fidel Fajardo Acosta. Stay tuned.
Guns and flags, oh, rock me in the cradle, child, carry me to the grave. Pledge allegiance to the doctrine, know you're gonna be saved. My Bible's guns and flags. Everybody fall in line, praise the Lord and do the time. Follow the rules, forget the truth. 21 gun salute. Bibles, guns, and flags.
All right. Bibles, guns, and flags, all right? And that's from Sunny Meadows. And someday I'm going to play that whole damn song, maybe that whole album. Maybe I'll just come in one day and just play that entire album because it'll blow your mind. And I'm very happy to welcome to the show now Professor Fidel Fajardo Acosta. He's a professor at a university in the Midwest, and he's also on the professor watch list. He's been part of an effort to issue calls to professor students and everyone in academia to actually take a stand, resist the fascist Trump regime and the coming assault on the academy. And he is right in the middle of the assault on the academy, so we're going to talk with him about that and learn a lot right now. Fidel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. So let's jump into this. You've been placed on the professor watch list. Just what is this and where did it come from?
Well, this professor watch list is a blacklist that's intended to stir hate and persecution against liberal academics. It's a typical tool of right-wing extremists who want to unleash witch hunts and stir mass hysteria and try to incite angry mobs to attack their targets. The anti-communist McCarthyism of the 1950s and its blacklisting of liberal intellectuals and artists is an example of those kinds of movements and their tactics. This particular list is posted by an organization that calls itself Turning Point USA. This is a political attack group that pretends to be a student grassroots organization, but instead is financed by billionaire political extremists. The idea of using groups of this sort is very old, by the way. It goes back to the 1930s when corporations like DuPont were trying to stage a fascist coup, the so-called business plot against FDR, whom they considered a socialist. There is an excellent book that just came out last year. It's Jane Meyer's Dark Money that describes in detail the efforts of billionaire extremists like Charles and David Koch, who have created a vast network of fake nonprofit organizations that they use to finance these kinds of operations. Groups like Turning Point USA are typical of the approach that Meyer calls AstroTurf strategy. These are groups pretending populist and grassroots inspiration, But in reality, they are being created and maintained by very rich individuals with agendas of seizing political power. The whole Tea Party is an example of these groups, too.
Yeah. Now, what kind of professors have been put on these lists? Like you, for instance, what did you do to get on this list, and how has it impacted you?
Yes, these clearly are liberals. This organization, Turning Point USA, has claimed very clearly that it's an organizer of the right trying to combat the left. So these are public statements that Turning Point USA has made. So they are by no means an apolitical organization, and they do not have any kind of balance or objectivity in their judgments. The people they're placing on this list are liberals who criticize the market economy, who advocate for social justice, for gender equality, for environmental protections. So it's just a standard list of liberal agendas that are the target of persecution of this group. Now, I personally got on the list because I ridiculed Donald Trump in a final exam, and I called him an evil man and the Antichrist. I work at a Catholic university, and I did this because Trump's agendas are the opposite of the message of love and helping others that is the hallmark of genuine Christianity. I'm also disgusted by Trump's racism, his sexism, and his attacks against Muslims and Mexicans. I myself am Mexican. I'm an American citizen, but I grew up in Mexico, and I'm proud to speak out against a hate monger and a sleazy character like Trump. The university where I work, however, took the side of Turning Point USA and has defended them and helped them in their persecution against me. At first, I was puzzled as to why a Catholic Christian university would side with someone like Trump and a gang of thugs like Turning Point USA. But soon it became apparent that the wealthy members of the Board of Trustees at the university, they share the aims and ideologies of these people.
Mm.
It's amazing that this Charles Koch Foundation has made a very huge donations to the university. So the Koch influence has come to dominate every aspect of what the university does, even to the extent of trying to transform the university into a money-making business. Very much like Trump University, complete with all these programs that have very dubious academic value. And there's this overcharging of students for tuition that is going mostly to executives, to corporations. I believe the real motivation for the attack of this Turning Point USA against me is the fact that I've been a critic of the university's trustees and administration, who I believe have betrayed their obligations and are in fact defrauding students and the government by diverting tuition money into private pockets.
Now, are there actually, one of the things I read, I know you're talking about who's actually behind all this, but one of the things I read as I was preparing for this is that there's also on some of these universities, there are these fascists, these little fascist bands of students that actually have been encouraged to do things like turn their teachers in. And I remember way back, in the 80s, where at Dartmouth, there was this little crew of people that some of them went on to become major right-wing forces in the U.S. government and whatnot, and pundits. And they were always out there talking. They would sit in classrooms and they'd take notes of what their professors were saying and then turn them into various right-wing, reactionary, fascistic forces then. But now you have this whole organized movement, this articulated movement of fascists. And these students are, as I understand, bands of students are actually encouraged to turn people like you in.
Yes, yes. It's correct to actually call them thugs because these groups operate undercover. They pretend to be promoting fiscal responsibility, free markets, and limited government. So that tends to be their line and supposedly their interest. But the main purpose of this group is, while undercover of those ideas, is to harass and persecute liberal academics. The group is criminal, this Turning Point USA, because it incites hate and violence and raises attacks against individuals based on their ideas, their political views, and even their ethnicity. The leaders of this Turning Point USA at the university where I work have been documented engaging in academic dishonesty, launching waves of hate mail, obscenities, and racial slurs against faculty, and making hate-related statements in social media, including expressing approval of the murder of African Americans. Now, members of this organization have also acted in ways that are totally dishonorable to the U.S. Armed Forces by posing in uniform, because some of these people are members of ROTC, and they pose in their uniform for these political propaganda publications. That is completely contrary to the code of conduct of anyone in the military. And this group is further engaged in tax fraud, because it claims a 501c3 nonprofit status, while in reality its aims are purely political.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Fidel Fajardo Acosta, a professor of English at a university in the Midwest, and we're talking about the right-wing professor's watch list, which targets critical thinking and dissent on U.S. college campuses. We're also talking about the call to make the university a zone of resistance to the fascist Trump regime and the coming assault on the academy. Now, tell me something. Do you know of ties, direct ties that this has with the Trump-Pence regime?
Well, this definitely is a very good question. What we're seeing here, groups that are being financed secretly. And so their funding is hard to establish, but only because it's enacted through this system of anonymous donations and all this money laundering across a large number of fake nonprofit organizations. Now, Jane Meyer's book, which is called Dark Money, explains these mechanisms very nicely. A multitude of these shell corporations and nonprofits, they help individuals like the Koch brothers keep a seeming distance from Trump, but this is only an appearance. They work together, and it's possible to see in the specifics of the ideologies that they are advocating and also the existence of this system of for the distribution of money through anonymous donations. It's possible to see that there is a definite connection between the Trump supporters as well as the sources of this funding, the creation of these kinds of groups. I also happen to know that there are members of the Board of Trustees of this university where I work that happen to have provided all kinds of facilities for the promotion of the Trump election and who also are connected to these ideologies and who are funding together with the Koch brothers certain pseudo think tanks within the university that claim to be pursuing research in economics, but in reality are doing political propaganda and creating fake science to try to support the businesses run by these people. So the connections are, you know, most definitely there.
Now, have there been students who've stepped forward to support people who've been hit by this this whole reactionary onslaught?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've had, as a matter of fact, you know, terrific support from people who have written to the university's president and to administrators trying to support me. And they created also a petition online on a website called change.org. So the only problem, of course, is that the university completely ignored all statements of support and only accepted and responded to and even placed in my file critical statements and the communications from members of these attack groups. So it was a very one-sided response on the part of the administration in acknowledging only criticisms of me, but not responding in any way to anyone trying to support me, and that, of course, also added to the evidence that there was involvement of the people at high level at the university with this group, supporting this group, pretending not to support it, but in reality allowing it to carry out its work, persecuting faculty, and trying to then the university discipline faculty for speaking against Trump. And so there are a number of tight connections between university administrators and trustees, these attack groups and Trump sympathizers, which is very unfortunate. Many faculty and students, of course, are more enlightened people, and they try to resist these abuses, but the institution simply ignores those kinds of responses, those positive, supportive responses.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and I really want to get into this next part, because I was going to ask you, you know, there's a reason why I think they go after the universities the way they've been going after them, setting up these kinds of organizations and going after progressive and radical-minded professors, and professors who basically are concerned about things like science, reality, truth, you know, and understanding the world as opposed to, you know, incinerating the world, that kind of stuff, right? So I'd ask you to just touch on that, about why you think they've decided to go after the universities, but you're also one of the initial signers of a call to professors, students, and all in academia that starting this semester make the university a zone of resistance to the fascist Trump regime and the coming assault on the academy. And I'd like you to talk about that too. What does it mean to make the university a zone of resistance?
Yes. As you pointed out, you know, universities are, they're a main threat to business interests because they pursue truth and the public good. And universities are sites of critical thinking where young people and academics come together and try to rethink and remake our ways of life and try to improve the human existence and bring about a situation that is more conducive to justice and the well-being of everyone. So thinking academics are well aware that the market economy is a scam, for example, that hurts the majority of people and benefits only a very few dishonest and criminal individuals. Now, this kind of knowledge, of course, is not acceptable to private interests. Controlling universities allows businesses to suppress truth and also means access to the minds of young people, transforming universities into these factories of political propaganda and fake research. Businesses can advance their totalitarian agendas and increase their profits, too. So making the universities into a zone of resistance is a very important task, which means ensuring intellectual freedom and the autonomy of knowledge and truth from business influence. Resistance means not being afraid to speak and teach what we know to be true. Also ensuring that the universities are living up to their obligations and their stated values. Christian University, for example, should stand against racism and fascism and hate and should openly denounce figures like Trump. Pope Francis did. You know, he said very clearly that someone who wants to build walls is not a Christian. And, you know, making friends with rich people and sacrificing truth and decency is completely contrary to what a university should be doing, and it should be denounced as a form of fraud. So I think people need to speak up. It's the primary responsibility we have because silence is the main problem. These institutions manage to get away with what they do through secrecy and privacy and confidentiality, and in this way they do all sorts of illegal and unethical things. You know, just as in the days of the McCarthy Red Scare, intellectuals were aware of the dangers and threats posed by rising fascism. But there's this tremendous fear on the part of people of speaking up because they're going to lose their jobs and they're going to face retaliation. But, you know, we could say, you know, like FDR, that the only thing that we should truly be afraid of is fear itself and silence.
Mm-hmm. All right, Fidel, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
No problem, Michael. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and we'll stay in touch, man. We'll keep up on this. We'll stay in touch, all right?
Absolutely.
All right, great, man. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Professor Fidel Fajardo Acosta, a professor of English in the Midwest, and he's on a professor watch list. He was just talking to us about what that means and the need to stand up and resist this. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with a special segment of the show that I had a chance to have a conversation with Aaron Brockovich yesterday, and we'll talk about that in just a second. So, musical break and be right back. Welcome back. That's Action Speaks Louder Than Words, and it's by Chocolate Milk, all right? And it's a great and fitting song. Consumer advocate and environmental activist Aaron Brockovich spoke to me yesterday in a very interesting interview on plans to reopen the Aliso Canyon gas field. In 2015-2016, the gas field was the site of the biggest gas leak in U.S. history, causing widespread sickness in the nearby community of Porter Ranch. Thousands had to leave their homes. And now, the same people that brought you all that are coming up and saying, hey, everything's cool. Let's listen to what we had to talk with Aaron Brockovich about, all right? You know, just the other day, I was reading about something that we covered a while back, more than a year ago, was what was happening to the Aliso Canyon gas field and to all the people that lived around there. And I kept thinking about the person I wanted to talk to back then was Aaron Brockovich, the consumer advocate and environmental activist who just blew everybody's mind because everybody still thinks of Aaron Brockovich as that kick butt woman in that film who just went out and said, I'm not going to let them destroy my life or anybody else's life. So there, I'm going after them. And I'm really pleased to welcome Aaron Brockovich to the show today, and we're going to be talking about the plans to, guess what, reopen the Aliso Canyon gas field. She recently noted that 2/3 of the wells at Aliso Canyon remain unchecked or have failed inspections, putting local residents at unnecessary risk, and we're going to dig into all that. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you? Sorry, I'm stuffy. I have a head cold.
That's all right.
Thanks for having me.
That's good. See, now you say you sound like, man, I've just been working like crazy. So that's good, all right? And which you have been, I'm sure. Let's just jump into these questions. It's, you know, there's a mounting effort by SoCal Gas Company to reopen the Aliso Canyon storage site. And when I saw that, I was kind of like, what? Really? What are they talking about? And people have to remember that was the site of a major methane leak that caused massive sickness, not just people having a few headaches and things, but massive sickness and probably a whole lot of other problems that we don't even know about yet. You describe this as being akin to opening Pandora's box. Why?
It's really kind of silly to even talk about reopening that site, clearly after what's happened. Most importantly, because they've not been transparent in the past. They have lied. They knew what was going to happen was going to happen, and it did. They have only tested and approved 34 of the wells. There's two-thirds of 170 some, I believe, that are still unchecked. We circulated last night at a meeting some photos of some of these unchecked wells that have pinholes that are corroded that could go at any time. So this just goes to show, again, they're still not being transparent with the people. They're still not being honest. And they're lying, and they want to open the well field again and potentially have another disaster. It makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
So opening up Pandora's box, I guess, would be doing just that. It is a very old well field. It's been there for 65-plus years. They don't know the condition of most of the pipes. It's antiquated. There's new technology. There's better ways for them to move forward. You have a huge community on top of this oil and gas field. It's time to permanently shut it down. Do what's right with the disaster you already caused so this community can live in peace and move on, Sempra, and find a more efficient way to handle your business.
Let's step back a minute, too, because people don't think realize what happened at Aliso Canyon was something, you know, when you talk about it being a catastrophe, it was a catastrophe, and it was like a catastrophe on the level of what you've pointed out is of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. That was huge, and the effects of that. Let's talk about that original. How can anybody look at, like, what happened there? And I think this is what they do to people. They get us to look at just, like, bits and pieces that we get shown. And, well, we didn't see, like, bodies, you know, shriveling up and burnt from, you know, whatever acid in the air or anything like that. But there was, like, all this stuff that was just unleashed. And this being a catastrophe that was, like, just huge on the level of the BP oil spill, that changed the whole makeup of a whole part of the planet for a very long time.
Well, I think that people began to understand that as they saw that infrared plume map, which was magnificent, because a lot of times you can't always see like water pollution and you don't always smell the chemicals. And in this situation, it was very hard to see visually. On certain days, you might see what appeared to be like plumes or fog or something, but the infrared really showed us. And the amount that came out did affect the climate at a very large level. And this is a gas. For me, if you just say you gassed those people for almost 6 months is exactly what you did. There's stuff in natural gas and the chemicals that they put in there so you can smell the natural gas that can make you sick. This was at high levels. It was enormous amounts. It went on for days and for months. I was up there. You cough, you gag, you feel like the air is being sucked out of your lungs. Birds were dying. Kids were complaining of nosebleeds. People having asthma attacks set off. It gives you chronic headaches. We felt disoriented up there. We felt like we were drunk. You felt kind of slurred speech. I mean, that is no way for anybody to live for 6 months, let alone the uncertainty of what their future health could be. And the fact that most of us are, listen, I live very near that area. To find out that that's what, about the second largest natural gas reserve in the United States, built on a fault line, you got a leak like that. What if there's a fire? What if there's a big earthquake? What about an explosion? These are all very severe risk factors. You've built an entire community on top of it. They don't know their future impact, and they just got put through the ringer because they couldn't shut down the well. This could easily happen again. And you don't know the condition of the rest of the wells. We can have this argument forever. It is stupidity to even try to come back in and want to open that well field and convince this community that they're, in fact, going to be safe.
Yeah, it's a very important point. You know, one of the things that I kept thinking about as I was reading about this and then just listening to you talk, you know, all these unanswered questions. Again, do they actually come out and say, okay, now we've got everything fixed. Don't worry about it. Everything's cool. We're going to be able to handle it. Just step back and let us go. And we'll make life better for everybody. Is that what they're saying?
Well, they're going to try to say they're not, you know, they need the gas. There's going to be brownouts. And there's not. Their reason is money. It's always money-driven and profit-driven and forsaking the health and safety and welfare of the community. There's enough evidence to show that it's not safe. And the people are coming out in large numbers again, and they want to be heard, and they don't want it reopened, and they want it shut down permanently. And I really believe that we're at that time where Semper Energy, if the state doesn't force a hand, you know, through the law and the people, it's a situation where it should not be revisited. And again, it's time for Semper to move on from this into cleaner, more efficient ways of energy and storage. And we even look at what Tesla did for Southern Cal Edison and the big cell towers that they opened up in, what, 88 days. And we're still grappling here with a well field and a gas storage facility that's 65-plus years old, already had a disaster, has confirmed wells that have pinholes in them, cases are corroded, they're deteriorated, rest of the wells, they don't know the condition. I just think it's ridiculous that we're having this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that we have to have it, actually. It's insane. Yeah, exactly. Now, one of the things that really got me, too, is that, you know, when you're talking about this, they do make an argument that they have done the work to do the repairs to make things safe. Like I said, they were talking about refilling the whole thing and that it's all safe now, that they've done the work, that they've taken care of this thing, you know, which raises questions immediately. Like you were saying, you were indicating about the condition of the fields there and the tanks and whatnot. This opens up questions about the quality of the repair process as well as the repairs that have been done, test results that they tested all this, air quality, all that kind of stuff. Nothing seems to be spoken to along those lines. You know they're lying. What do you say to that when they actually argue that they've done all this work?
First of all, they should have done a little work on the well that leaked that caused the problem for 6 months, because they knew before that even happened there was a problem. That's on you, Sempra, and you should have come in and fixed it. And you're coming back again and lying again. You only have 34 approved wells. Two-thirds of them are not approved. That you know by your own admissions and your own photographs that there's pinholes, that they're leaking. You're saying in your propaganda that everything's safe. Oh, no. Of the only 34 that are approved, what about the rest of them? They've breached the trust with the state and with the community, and they should not be trusted again.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with consumer advocate and environmental activist Aaron Brockovich, and we're talking about the plans to reopen the Aliso Canyon gas field, which in 2015, 2016, it was the gas field that was the site of the biggest gas leak in U.S. history, causing widespread sickness in the nearby community of Porter Ranch, with thousands having to leave their homes. People have been arguing, and I think the people themselves have been arguing, and it's an interesting point, they've been arguing that not only is this gas field no longer really needed, and you were indicating this in terms of the alternative forms of energy and whatnot, but that having this actually still poses a risk of what could still be catastrophic problems. Like it being there and being filled with what it's filled with, and the fact that this stuff has been so sloppy, and even the repairs that they say they've done, they're, you know, who knows what the quality of those repairs are. You would think it would argue against legally, if not just morally, ever trying to rebuild that and reopen that thing up.
Well, it is being argued legally. You are seeing, you know, again, at the hearing last night, Senator Dianne Feinstein's office read a statement from her, and it was eloquent. Permanently shut it down. Your supervisor feels the same way. Our current senators feel the same way. The health department is concerned about it. And the people are concerned about it. And the law will be there for them. But reopening it now would endanger that community again. And they've already hurt the community. They have already proven to us that it cannot operate safely. We know for a fact two-thirds of the wells are unchecked or unapproved, and Dogger still owes the residents an explanation about why it's been dragging its feet. Every single well out there is to be approved by Dogger, if you open it up and it's not done, you're waiting for another disaster. We've seen the extent of their failures. And Southern Cal Gas needs to get out of the past and learn how to begin to operate in a modern world.
Mm-hmm.
And American companies, such as Sempra, need to step up and adapt instead of cutting corners for profit. And that's exactly what they're going to do if they want to open up this well field. There's clean energy technology. They need to embrace it for the sake of Porter Ranch and the health and the welfare of the family. And like we just talked about, look, it took Tesla only 88 days to build and activate the world's largest energy storage facility for Southern Cal Edison. So there is absolutely no reason why Sempra cannot take the same approach to ensure the safety of Porter Ranch, a community that they've already done enough damage to, and the lack of transparencies and the lies keep coming.
What is the argument they make to what you just raised, that Tesla had done this in 88 days, they made this repair and were back to working? How do they justify what they're doing?
I've had heard no comment from them about that whatsoever. There's really a lot of explanation, and here we are at the hearing last night. PUC's there, Dodger's there, but Sempra's not there.
Mm-hmm.
So we can just regurgitate the exact same thing. Sempra's own test results on some of the unapproved wells out there by photographs that we have that should be presented at the hearing tonight clearly show in Sempra's records their root cause test results, wells with holes that are already leaking, but you want to open it up again.
Hmm.
You only have 34 approved wells. Two-thirds are not. You should not even come back and address this issue or ask to open that well field until every single well is accounted for and approved.
Then,
you should be permanently shut down.
Mm-hmm. You keep mentioning Sempra. What is Sempra?
Southern Cal Gas.
Okay, I was looking at SoCal. Okay.
Yeah, SoCal Gas.
One of the things that I read was that when all is said and done, that they're arguing to open things up again, but they actually do admit that they have not actually even done the necessary root cause analysis, which is required if they're even going to take the first step to open these things up, right?
Correct. Well, last night we circulated photos that they did, it came out in November, of a root cause of one well that clearly had pinholes, and that well was so corroded and deteriorated. Now, that's just one. What if you got 20 more? You're putting the cart before the horse to come in and even ask this when what you've been instructed to do is not even complete. It's like, why are we even having this conversation? So you can just upset the community again?
Yeah. You know, one thing I was going to ask you about, too, is that I thought that that was one of the most inspiring things that I saw in relation to this whole thing. And that was that actually people went in there and they were just so angry, but they were also so focused, and they didn't hesitate at all. And I thought there was that one man that was speaking on the microphone, and then they shut the mic off when he's like, he's just laying into them. They shut the mic off, and he pulls a bullhorn out of his case or whatever, and he picks that up and starts using it. But it seemed like people were really standing up and saying, we aren't going to live this way. We refuse to live this way, and we're not going to allow you to make us live this way, which I thought was really important.
Absolutely. It is very important, and I was very happy to see their response. I understand their frustration. They're not alone in that. And it would have been awful to shut down that meeting. It's a public hearing. They have a lot to say. They're the ones living there. They're the ones that have experienced it. They're still smelling gas. They're getting very concerned again. What damage has already been done has still not been corrected. They're fearful for their future. And they want transparency, and they're dealing with an entity they cannot trust, they should not trust, and they're speaking out. I'm frankly really proud of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's inspiring.
We all should be.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I just want to ask you one more question, and that is in order just to step back a little bit and also look into the future a little bit, which is people have to understand, what did this mean? You know, it wasn't just an inconvenience when this gas started leaking. It was actually, it had a real impact on people's lives. And we don't know what all the impact actually may be as time runs its course. Let's talk about just what was the impact? What was the actually down on the earth, people to people, what was the impact on people of what happened with this gas leak?
Well, they had to leave their homes. They got sick. People were hospitalized. Animals got sick. Animals died. They were disjointed, relocated, had to move furniture, give up furniture, schools were relocated. I mean, that's a lot. And you've left them with a future of uncertainty regarding their health. And what if it happens again? This is their home. This is their health. This is their life. These are their schools. You've disrupted their entire life for the sake of a company who, out of greed and profits, chose not to fix the situation and allow a disastrous situation to happen. And you open that well field again, and the next disaster could be triple what we've seen. Why would anybody take that calculated kind of risk?
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's the benefits of living in a profit-driven system. Aaron Brockovich, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for covering this. And again, you know, I'm so proud of the community using their voice. And I know I sound frustrated because I am frustrated. The idea of reopening this when you haven't even complied with what you're supposed to do after what you've already done and the lies continue is insanity.
It's insanity and it's criminal insanity.
Yes.
Basically. All right,
thanks.
Aaron. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, welcome back. That was Aaron Brockovich. I want to thank all of my guests today, Sansara Taylor, Fidel Fajardo Acosta, and Aaron Brockovich. I also want to thank all the people that helped put this show together. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, a man I haven't seen his face for quite some time, Teddy Robinson. Glad to have you back again, bro. And I'd like to thank all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And again, I want to mention the two websites that Sansara Taylor talked about, revcom.us, the site of Revolution Newspaper, and refusefascism.org for the latest on driving out Trump and Pence and the whole fascist regime. All right, so this really does bring us to the end of yet another show, and we're going to go out now with one of my favorite songs from one of my favorite bands, and that is Revolution Radio from Green Day. Talk to you again next week.